Okay, good morning everybody. This is Bio 231 Wednesday, and it's February 20th. So on the right-hand side, we see the schedule. So let's take a look at the schedule and see where we are. Today's the 20th, so indeed we're going to have a lecture on the integument. That's chapter 5. Those are the page numbers that you have to read. And those should be exactly the same page numbers as what you have in the study guide. Okay, it should be exactly, okay, it's still working. And then on Monday, we're going to have a lecture on bones and skeletal tissue. And then on Wednesday, 1 week from today, we're going to have exam 1. And these are the chapters, including bones and skeletal tissue. And I see a question. I bet I got an answer.
For exam 1?
Yeah?
For the exam study guide, it doesn't have the chapter 6.
Yeah, it goes up to chapter 5. Chapter 6 you can find under exam 2 study guide. Okay, so it's there, the figures that you're responsible for, the questions you're responsible for. It's just I haven't reorganized the class since we went to a shorter semester. But it's, so it's jammed together. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Exam 1 is chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, and 6. I forgot 6, right? Which is bones and skeletal tissue. All right, let me say that again. Exam 1, chapters 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6. Not chapter 3. 1, 2, 4, 5, 6. Okay. That's how it goes. And then, the week after that, starting Monday, we have our lab practicum. So next week, you get to study all your practical material. And people that are in the Monday class, the Monday afternoon class, you're welcome to come to any of my labs. It might get a little crowded, right? But come to any of my labs so that you can prepare for the practicum because you got gypped out of a lab when the power went out. And so I want you to make that work up. Your practicum will be very similar to any other lab. The material will be exactly the same. And then you also have to make up the quiz that you missed, which was a microscope quiz. So the Monday afternoon class is like really far behind everybody else. But you can catch up. You're not too far behind yet. Okay, and I want you to make up that quiz and then the skull quiz before exam number one, before the lab practicum number one, that Monday class. Everybody else will do it. And there, don't forget, there's an extra credit drawing in there as well. I sent out emails with it, and also, if I have time today, there is a nice video tutorial in Blackboard that I put up just a couple days ago that shows you how to draw the layers of the integument. And we're going to go over that today anyway, but I probably won't draw it out. I'll just show you some pictures. Okay, so any questions on the schedule? Exam 1 covers chapter 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6. Okay. All right, so let's get started with chapter 5. What the heck is the integument? Yeah, it's skin. Okay, the integument is skin, but there's something else there as well. So let me pull up a nice picture of skin. It also includes some accessory structures, and we're going to be using that term during the class. All right, so these are some structures that are closely associated with the organ that we're looking at. And remember, the integument really is an organ, and noteworthy thing is that it's the largest organ in your body or on your body. So the integumentary system is made of skin and some accessory structures like hair, nails, glands, and even a little bit of muscle. And you can move your skin around a little bit. What happens to your skin when you move it around, when that little muscle contracts? Ever remember moving your skin around? How does it move around? When you get cold, you get goosebumps. Okay, so your skin is actually moving around, and it's controlled by smooth muscle. It's not skeletal muscle. It's not under voluntary control. And you're thinking, well, gee whiz, doesn't move very much. And you're right, but nonetheless, there is a difference when you have goosebumps and when you don't. It's pretty easy to see. All right, so let's talk about the function. We have a number of functions that are attributed to the integumentary system. It protects internal structures from infections and dehydration. So the concept is protection, but it has two main components. Dehydration is very important. Without your integument, you would dehydrate in just a matter of minutes, and then, of course, you would die. So your skin keeps water inside your body, And if for whatever reason you lose your integument, that's a major concern for physicians, is dehydration. And what's a common way that people lose their skin? Like in burns, for instance. Yeah, that's the most common way. And of course, when somebody's burned, they're very susceptible to infections as well through the skin. And if your skin is nice and healthy, then you're really protected nicely from a lot of infectious materials. You could probably walk through sewer water as long as you don't have any cuts on your body, right? And you won't get infected. All right, so that's one thing, protection. The second thing is regulating body temperature. That's real important. When you're hot, there are certain glands on the skin that secrete water, and when that water evaporates, it really cools your body down. And also, when you're hot, there are blood vessels in your skin that dilate, that bring a lot of heat from your internal structures to the surface so that it can be used to evaporate water. And then when you're cold, of course, the blood vessels in your skin constrict, and that holds heat in the core of your person. Right? Your external body will be cold, but that's okay as long as you keep your heart and vital organs warm. Another important feature is vitamin D. Now, where the heck does that come from? Vitamin D is necessary to absorb calcium in your diet, and that's important to maintain at least strong bones, but we're going to learn some other things that calcium is real important for. And how do you get vitamin D? Does anybody know?
Sun.
Well, I thought sunlight was harmful to you. Not in the morning. Okay, pretty cool. So sunlight is important for producing, you know, and you're right, sunlight is important for producing a precursor to an active form of vitamin D. And so you do need some sunlight, but you don't need a whole lot because it can cause burns and it can also change skin cells into cancerous cells, like a basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, or a melanoma. And we're going to look at where some of these cells are located, right? So some sun is absolutely necessary, but too much is bad. And then sensation is another function of skin. So it's a way that you can communicate with your environment. So what kind of sensations can you recall? Pain and what did you say? Touch, yeah. Touch is real important. Okay, somebody pokes you on the back, you kind of look and see what's happening. Or, you know, you can feel the breeze on your face or over your head. Okay, if it's a warm breeze, cold breeze, or whatever, that's a hint for another sensation that you have. Temperature. Certainly you have temperature. Right? So if I took an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, would you feel it? Absolutely. You have temperature sensors, so you have cold receptors and warm receptors in your skin. Right, so that helps protect your body. All right, so let's start talking about skin, some of the anatomy of skin. And we're always interested in layers in this class. It seems maybe that students think it's just an ordeal of memorization, but it's really important to understand layers because that's how we diagnose disease, by knowing what layers are involved with the disease process. Right? Then we can diagnose what the disease is, and then we can figure out a way to treat it by knowing what's happening to these different layers. And if we know the different layers and how to treat something, then we also know what the prognosis is for the patient. So knowing layers is really important. What does prognosis mean? Prognosis means what are the possible outcomes of a particular kind of treatment. And you get all that information by knowing what layers are involved. All right, so the skin has two main layers. The deep layer is called the dermis. And let's look at this picture. All right, so the dermis starts right here and goes down to here. That is the dermis. And it's got two different kinds of connective tissue, which we're going to look at. And then down below the dermis, I see an areolar or adipose connective tissue. That is not part of the skin. But we put it on the slide, talk about it a little bit in the class because it's associated with the skin very closely. And what the adipose tissue does is that it helps attach your skin to underlying structures like muscles and bones. So it's important, right? But it's not really a part of the integumentary system. So here is the dermis, and I don't go into too much detail right now. Connective tissue. All right, well, I see these little bumps right here. These are what we call papillae, dermal papillae. And so this layer, about in this region right here, is what we call the papillary layer, named after these structures. Maybe I'll say something about those in just a little bit. So this is the papillary layer of the dermis. I see it labeled right here. It's a loose areolar connective tissue. So loose areolar connective tissue has some collagen fibers that are strong, some elastic fibers that are not so strong, but your skin can stretch and bend and goes back to its original shape because of those elastic fibers. And then the deep layer right here of the dermis contains a lot of collagen fibers. And I can see those collagen fibers on this diagram. And how strong is collagen? That's the strongest fiber, right? So this is the strongest layer of the skin. No matter where you look, epidermis or dermis, it is the reticular layer that's the strongest because it's loaded with collagen fibers. And these fibers go in all different directions. Some right to left, some top to bottom, some in and out of the plane of this image right here. So it is a dense connective tissue, but it is nonetheless still irregular. Irregular dense connective tissue, reticular layer. Okay. And then we have the epidermis. Why do we name this the epidermis? Because epi means on top of, right? And epidermis for sure means on top of the dermis. That's easy to understand. And so here is the epidermis. And indeed, you can see that the epidermis even has, in this illustration, different layers. And we're going to learn something about those different layers. And you should be able to draw all these layers out, the major layers and minor layers of the epidermis. Okay, I didn't say a whole lot about the hypodermis right here. What does hypo mean?
Under.
Underneath, deep to the dermis. So hypodermis, right, that makes a whole lot of sense. And sometimes the hypodermis is called the superficial fascia. And like I said, it just helps attach your skin to underlying structures. Okay, and as adipose connective tissue may store up to one half of a person's body fat. Just in that subcutaneous layer. Sometimes we call it a subcutaneous layer because it's underneath the skin, and the skin could be thought of as a cutaneous membrane. So these are just some terms that are used differently. Okay, let me talk a little bit about this figure. There is a video on my website. The video I think is produced for a Bio 160 class. This diagram, this illustration, has a little bit more detail than we go over in Bio 160, but you can listen to that video over and over and over again and learn something about these structures. You also have to know these structures for lab. We have models in lab, and the models have a little bit different structures, but that's okay. You get to know those because I have three videos in course documents in Blackboard that go over. One video is over the epidermis, one video is over the dermis, and then another video is over all the other structures, accessory structures in the skin. So it goes over layers and accessory structures. Okay, so when I look at this illustration right here, I see some sensory organs. And here is one. This is a Pacinian corpuscle, and you can see it has a lot of different layers to it. This is a receptor for deep pressure and vibration. So if somebody squeezes your hand really, really strongly, this is the receptor that you feel, that extreme pressure, Pacinian corpuscle here and here. There's another kind of corpuscle, and I don't see it on this illustration, but you have it in lab. It's called a Meissner's corpuscle, and it sits in this little papillae right here. It's a lot smaller, but it can sense very slight variations in pressure on the skin. So very slight vibrations and very slight touch can be felt by Meissner's corpuscles here. And as a matter of fact, some people can read with a Meissner's corpuscle. How can they read? How do you read? What organ do you use to read? Oh, you don't know? Well, I'm glad you took this anatomy class. Okay, what organ do you use to read? Yeah, your eyes, right? So you just look at some light coming off of a piece of paper and your occipital lobe makes sense of that. So you use your eyes. But if somebody's blind, okay, they can't use their eyes. And they can use their fingertips and they can feel certain bumps and ridges on a piece of paper, which we call Braille, right? And then they can figure out what that word is because the Braille spells out words for them, right? And it's those Meissner's corpuscles that are sensitive enough to feel those very small dimples on a piece of paper. And this is where they're located. I have some free nerve endings right here. Free nerve endings are the nerves for temperature. So there are some free nerve endings that respond to cold. There are some that respond to hot. And also free nerve endings allow you the sensation of pain. And is pain a good sensation to have? You're shaking your head no. And I would say, sure, don't go out of your way. But it is really important because if these pain nerve endings are anesthetized, for instance, you can't tell if that part of your body is being damaged or not. Right? So a pain sensation is really important because you know part of your body is being damaged, and then what happens? You remove your body from that damaging stimulus and you preserve your anatomy, right? So pain sensations are an important warning system in your body, and that's brought out by these free nerve endings. Here are some other free nerve endings on this hair follicle. So when this hair follicle brushes up against something or the wind blows against it, right, then you can feel that motion with these receptors right here, these free nerve endings. What are some other things? Glands. I see one kind of gland, but there are three altogether. In lab, you get to see all three. Oh, I see two. I see two kinds of glands. There is one kind of gland that is always associated with a hair follicle, and it's called a sebaceous gland. The sebaceous gland secretes sebum, which is an oily solution, and that helps lubricate the shaft of this hair so it doesn't get trapped in the hair follicle. Right? And that oil also has a little bit of an antibacterial property, so that helps control infection on your skin and a hair follicle in particular. So I see a sebaceous gland here, and it continues over here. And what is this thing? What is this? It's another sebaceous gland. It's just cut open so that you can see some layers of a sebaceous gland. Now, what kind of tissue? What kind of tissues do you, how many tissues are there in the body? There are four. And you should know what they are. Epithelium, what's another one? Connective, muscle and nervous tissue. And so this right here is what kind of tissue of those four? Yeah, it's an epithelium. So epithelium covers a surface or lines a cavity, but it does something else. Does anybody remember what that other special thing was? It makes glands. So here we see a sebaceous gland, and you can see indeed it really is made out of the epidermis, which is an epithelium. Okay? And this gland right here also has an epithelium that lines these tubes that secretes a product into this tube, which goes to the surface of the skin. And this is what we call an eccrine sweat gland. An eccrine sweat gland produces a salty and watery solution. And so that watery solution, when it gets to the surface of the skin, evaporates and cools a person's body down quite a bit. Because it takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of heat to evaporate water. So it cools you down a lot. And that's all I want to say about it. A lot of other interesting things to say about that. But talk to me in lab if you're interested about this eccrine. One other gland that we have in lab, but we don't see right here, is called an apocrine gland. Apocrine, so it's A-P-P-O-C-R-I-N-E. Apocrine gland, and it's bigger. It's about maybe 10 times the size of this eccrine gland. And it's a sweat gland. It doesn't secrete sweat, but it secretes an organic solution, right? And that organic solution helps control bacteria on our skin. Some bacteria can use those secretions to grow, and when those bacteria grow, then harmful bacteria can't exist on your skin, right? So your skin is really an ecosystem. You want to have the right kind of bacteria growing on it and not the pathological kind of bacteria. I'll say more about the apocrine gland in lab. All right, so three kinds of glands. Here's another accessory structure, the arrector pili. It's a smooth muscle. So can you control this arrector pili with your conscious thought? No, because it's smooth muscle, right? But when it does contract, right, usually these hair follicles are kind of lying down on your skin. So the root of this hair follicle is mostly horizontal, but when this arrector pili contracts, it raises, okay, this hair follicle so that it's perpendicular to your skin. But notice the arrangement. It also kind of pulls it up toward the surface of your skin. And what it does, it produces a little dome-shaped structure, which we commonly call in everyday vernacular a goose bump or a goose pimple. You can't control when you get them, right? It's usually when you're cold or some kind of emotional stimulus, you can get goose pimples when this muscle contracts, and you can't make goose pimples go away or turn on. So that's the arrector pili muscle. Okay, so those are some of the accessory structures. I think I covered just about every one that's on the slide, and I'm sure this is an exam figure. Okay, and if you know it's not, just let me know and I'll correct myself, but I'm almost sure it is an exam figure. So you should be able to label all of these lead lines right here. Okay, one characteristic of an epithelium is that it is avascular. Avascular means that it doesn't have blood vessels. And indeed, I don't see any blood vessels in this diagram right here, right? But I do see blood vessels in the papillary layer of the dermis and, of course, the reticular layer. So if somebody lacerates just their epidermis, of course, that won't produce any kind of hemorrhage because there's no blood vessels there. But if you ever cut yourself and you do bleed, if you do hemorrhage, what layer do you at least know has been cut along with the epidermis? At least the dermis, right? Maybe the papillary layer, okay, because that's where you have blood vessels. And probably we've all done that, gotten a paper cut. I see some nerves going up into the epidermis, got a paper cut, feels really bad, it kind of stings, and you don't even want to look at that cut because you think you're going to see a lot of blood, and then you get the courage up to look, and what? Not even any blood, right? So no sympathy from anybody, and that's because you only cut into the epidermis, right, where there are no blood vessels. Okay, so let's take a look at some of these layers in the epidermis. So this epidermis, right, I see a layer right here, and then a little bit darker layer, there are two layers here, and then another layer up over here, and these cells are flat on the apical surface of this epithelium. So you can tell me what kind of epithelium the skin has. We want to characterize it by the number of layers and the shape of the cells. So it's stratified because it has many layers, and the shape of the cells are squamous. All right, so important thing about a stratified squamous epithelium is that this is the living layer where I have the cursor, and these cells are undergoing mitosis, and they produce new cells that move up into the next superficial layer, and they get pushed up into the next superficial one, and then finally the most superficial layer right here, okay, they move all the way up over here, and when they're in this layer, they're very far away from blood vessels in the dermis. And so these cells cannot be alive. They don't have enough nutrients and oxygen. But these layers are important because this epithelium is designed to rub off of your body. And that's no big deal because what happens if some of these cells rub off? Well, the cells underneath it just replace the ones that rub off as long as you don't overdo it. Same thing with the cells in your mouth. That's a stratified squamous epithelium. And you remember harvesting some of those cells. We looked at them underneath the microscope. But when we took a bunch of those cells out, maybe even a couple hundred thousand cells, you didn't have a hole in your cheek, right? Because it's a stratified squamous epithelium, right? It resists abrasion. What does that mean? Resists abrasion. If you don't know what abrasion is, you got to look that up in a dictionary or Google it or something. But I'd be happy to tell you, what's abrasion? Friction is rubbing. It's rubbing on something, right? So this kind of epithelium can rub up against your clothes, right? A pair of glasses or rings or whatever, and you don't wear a hole in your body because it's designed to do that. And remember, what's another function of the skin? Because you don't want to damage it. Protection from infectious agents, but it's also protection from what? Dehydration. It prevents you from dehydrating. So the epidermis is what we call a permeability barrier. It's like a saran wrap that your body is wrapped in so that you do not dehydrate. So that's what I mean by permeability barrier right here. All right, let me look at some more slides, and we're going to talk about the epidermis in particular. And I think this is a pretty good view right here. Yeah, let's look at this one. Okay, so here was the illustration that we were looking at. It's kind of shrunk down to a thumbnail. And now we're going to zoom into this region and enlarge it to what we see over here. Now, the color doesn't really look the same, but this region right here is actually coming from this region. So, what we have, here's a dermal papillae poking up into the dermis, and all of this is the epidermis. This is the free edge, here's a free space above the epithelium, and then here's the basement membrane right here, and this is the first layer. It's one cell layer thick, maybe two, and we call that the stratum basale. because this is the basal layer of this epithelium. These cells are nice and alive because they're close to blood vessels in the dermis. I need a way to make that picture right. Let's try this. Okay, so those cells are really close to the blood vessels, so they're nice and alive. These cells can undergo mitosis. Right, so what is mitosis good for? Growth and replace old and damaged cells. Right, so mitosis then produces two daughter cells from one parent cell. One of the daughter cells then starts to migrate up to the surface to help replace these cells that get rubbed off. Right, so the basal surface is alive and we say it's proliferating. Proliferating is just a kind of cell that is undergoing mitosis, right, and making more copies of itself. So when a cell moves up away from the basal layer, it moves up into this next one right here. And look at the shape of these cells, especially this one. It's got pointy ends to it. I see a little pointy end here, pointy end there, another pointy end here, and these cells turn into little spiky cells. They're attached to each other, okay, with desmosomes, and that just distorts these cells, and they get pushed and pulled in certain directions to where they have these sharp edges on them. And so we characterize this layer as being the stratum spinosum, or spiny layer, because of all these sharply pointed cells. But still, I don't see a lot of structure in them. I maybe see a nucleus, but it's mostly the shape because of the connections between cells that we call desmosomes. All right, and then they migrate up to the surface, and they move into the next layer. And I see some interesting things in this layer right here. When you look at these cells, can you tell me what do you see? Could you characterize that at all? What do you see in this layer? What are all these little things? Yeah, they're dots. But we're going to call them granules. And where do you find these granules? Outside the cell or inside the cell? Yeah, I see them inside the cell. And these granules right here, okay, are filled with a precursor of a chemical called keratin. And where do I have keratin on this slide right here? Keratohyalin. Okay, here is the precursor to keratin. It's called keratohyalin. That's what's in these little granules. It will eventually be converted to keratin, and keratin is a hard chemical. So it kind of hardens up your skin. Right? And so remember, your nails are a part of your skin. So they're just skin cells. They're flat, just like what I see over here. And you think the cells that make up your nails have more keratin or less compared to the cells that make up your skin, like on the palm of your hand or the posterior surface of your hand?
More,
because it's hard. Okay? And the cells that make up hair also have more keratin than what's in your skin, but not quite as much as your nails. It's hard, but it's not as hard as your nails. So keratin is important because it helps protect your body. It's sort of like a little armor plating. So these cells then that have keratin in them are called keratinocytes, and they're pretty tough. Okay. And also these cells secrete a lipid between them, and that lipid then is a permeability barrier because water doesn't like to mix with oil or lipid. Okay, so this layer that has all these granules in it is called the stratum granulosum. That's pretty easy to see. Then, in this particular kind of skin that has hair follicles all over the place, has one more layer. And it's a real thick layer, has a bunch of squamous cells, and I don't see any nuclei in any of these cells because this layer is dead. It's way too far away from blood vessels in the dermis to maintain life in these cells. But nonetheless, they're important because they protect your skin, allow your skin to rub off of you. And so these are dead cells that we call, well, they're keratinocytes, but when they die like this, they're filled with keratin. We say that they are cornified. Right? They turn into really hard cells. So this layer right here is called the stratum corneum, filled with squamous cornified cells that are dead a long time ago when you look at the surface of your body. Here you can actually see some cells that are about ready to rub off right here. But that's no big deal because there's many cells underneath it. Okay, so the kind of skin that has hair follicles right here has these four layers. And of course you got to know the layers from superficial to deep or deep to superficial. So here you have the basali, spinosum, granulosum, and then corneum with stratum in front of them. All right, so you got to know the names of these things. Don't forget stratum and the order in which they exist. This kind of skin is what we call thin skin. That's what we have over most of our body. I didn't really mention thin skin in lab yet. But there's another kind of skin. And I see it over here. Okay, this kind of skin doesn't have any hair follicles, you know, on it. Oh no, this is actually just an illustration of the previous slide. And I want to go over this. All right, so here is a nice micrograph of some skin. And it was stained probably with methylene blue or something. And here's an illustration of that nice micrograph. And we can see all the layers, once again, the stratum basali. And I don't see any cells undergoing mitosis, but you might see some cells with the chromosomes all lined up right on the equator of the cell. What stage of mitosis would that be? That would be metaphase, for sure. Okay, so here's the basali. Then above that are going to be these spiky cells, the stratum spinosum, and then stratum granulosum, and then the stratum corneum right here. So we do want to know something about the chemicals. The chemical inside the cells is called keratin. That's why we call these keratinocytes. Okay, but you also know another kind of chemical, which is really strong and tough. It kind of sounds like keratin, but it's not. What is a word that's kind of close to keratin, which is another strong chemical that you learned about? It makes a fiber in particular. Collagen, yeah. So don't mix up keratin and collagen. Probably I shouldn't have told you because now it's easy to mix them up. But don't mix them up, okay? Where do you find keratin? Two different locations. This will help you understand the difference between keratin and collagen. Or maybe a better question is, where do you find collagen? Inside the cell or extracellular? Yeah. Collagen is in the matrix of a connective tissue. Keratin, on the other hand, is intracellular within these keratinocytes. So different kinds of chemical compounds performing sort of the same kind of function, but in two different locations. Okay, we got some other cells that I want you to know about. Okay, within this basal layer, we do have some tactile cells, which can allow you to feel vibrations and slight touch. This looks like a Merkel's disc. I don't know if that's in a question at the end of the chapter or an online question, and you should know the name of the cell, but otherwise just know that this is a tactile cell. And in your notes, maybe write down Merkel, M-E-R-K-E-L is the name of this cell. And then here is another one, and it has a bunch of tentacles poking out all over in between the spaces between these cells. This is a melanocyte. And a melanocyte is another kind of cell, just like a keratinocyte, and it produces a chemical compound, but it doesn't produce keratin, it produces melanin. So that's another name of a chemical that you have to know. So now you know what, elastin, collagen, keratin, and here's another one, melanin. And this cell is dark. Melanin is a pigment, right? And does anybody know what a pigment is? What's a pigment? Yeah, it produces color because a pigment is a chemical that can absorb light. And white light is made up of all colors of the rainbow. So if you have a pigment that absorbs all colors except yellow, all right, what is it going to look like? So that pigment is gobbling up red, gobbling up green, purple, violet, but it's not gobbling up yellow. Guess what light you see? It reflects yellow, that goes into your eye, and that thing, because it has that pigment, looks yellow to you because it absorbs all those other pigments. This pigment right here is very dark. It could be black, could be dark brown. So when it's black, okay, what colors of the rainbow is it absorbing? It's absorbing all of them, right? So here's a cell that protects your body from the harmful effects of the sun. Okay, and it's called a melanocyte. And the pigment that absorbs all that harmful radiation from the sun is called melanin. Right? So people that have a family history from the more equatorial regions of the planet, which means that they have a much more solar challenge, right, then they have more pigments in their skin from these melanocytes. People that have a history or family history from Northern Europe where the sun is not particularly bright or damaging, then they have lighter color skin. Right, so don't forget, these melanocytes produce a natural sunscreen that protects your skin. And as a matter of fact, it protects your skin no matter where you're living. Right? If you have very light-colored skin and go out in sunlight around here during the summer, you probably can get burned in just a couple minutes. Right? So if you have very fair skin, you always got to protect yourself with a hat or shirt or sunscreen. Okay, but if you have darker color skin, then you can go out in that damaging sunlight to some extent, and it protects your body. And guess what the most damaging thing you can do to your skin is? The most damaging thing is to go out in sunlight unprotected, because it damages all these cells. It damages the elastic fibers and collagen fibers. All right. So somebody that has dark skin, their skin just stays younger for a much longer period of time compared to somebody that has lighter skin. Okay, so don't forget, melanocyte produces melanin, which is a pigment. Here is another cell, a dendritic cell. It has tentacles as well. We're going to call these processes, these projections from a cell. And a dendritic cell is important for immune response. It protects infection. And it doesn't really crawl around in the various layers, but it has all these protections that kind of spreads out in this layer. And another name for a dendritic cell is called a Langerhans cell. And I think that's probably an answer to one of the questions someplace in your book or online. All right, so a dendritic cell is also called a Langerhans. And that's just the name of somebody that first found it and described what it was doing. So here's a Langerhans cell. This probably is an exam figure. But if you look at the study guide, this figure maybe looks a little bit different, because I like the figure a lot more in the previous edition than this one. The previous edition's figure is a lot clearer than this one, but maybe I switched it out. I can't remember. Right? But if you see an illustration like this with keratinocytes and melanocytes, basal layer, the previous edition of your book did call this a Langerhans cell. I can't remember what's in your study guide. Nonetheless, it's important for immune response. So we got four layers: the stratum basale, stratum spinosum, stratum granulosum, and stratum corneum in the part of your skin that has hair follicles. Well, there's a part of your body, part of your skin, that does not have hair follicles. Does anybody know where that is? What part of your body doesn't have hair follicles all over it? Okay, you might say, well, your face, but you know what? If you look really closely, okay, maybe with a microscope or a dissecting microscope, you're going to see hair follicles all over your face, all over your arms, okay, all over your legs, no matter where you look. But where's one place that doesn't? That's right, palms of your hands, soles of your feet don't have hair follicles, and also the structure of the epidermis changes a little bit. That's what we call thick skin. Okay, but I would really like to meet somebody that has hair on the palms of their hands. Does anybody here have hair on the soles of your feet, palms of your hands? I have never found anybody, but we're all different, so I know someplace in the world there's got to be somebody. Okay, because I'd really like to take a picture of it too. But don't tell them that, okay? If you know somebody that has hair there, don't tell them. Okay, yeah, they might shave it before they come and see me. Okay, so here is a nice micrograph. Okay, I can just barely see some cells right here, so it's not a very high resolution, but I can see the epidermis from here up to here, and then, of course, I can see the dermis. So let's go over some of these layers once again. And this particular skin, I don't see any hair follicles anywhere, so this is what we call thick skin that we have on the palms of our hands and soles of our feet. So the deep layer is what we call the dermis, right? And the dermis has two layers. First, this layer right here, which is areolar connective tissue, has a little bit of collagen, but not a lot. Has some elastic tissue, but not a lot. And that sunlight, if it's not blocked, can damage that elastic tissue, and it really damages the skin as a result. And it can damage the collagen, and it hurts the fibroblasts that secretes those fibers into the matrix. So here's the papillary layer. It's named after these projections up into the epidermis. These are what we call dermal papillae. So that's how we name this layer right here, papillary layer. The deep layer of the dermis, I can see some fibers all over the place, really big fibers. Can you take a guess what those are made out of? Collagen, that's right. So, and we call this the reticular layer. That's by far the strongest layer in the skin, because it's loaded with with collagen. All right, so that's dermis. Now here is the epidermis in something we call thick skin. The stratum corneum is a lot thicker compared to thin skin, but it also has an additional layer. All right, let's look at the layers, starting with the stratum basale. Here I can see the stratum basale. Maybe if you look very closely, you can see some melanocytes in here. If you see any cells that are a little bit more brown than others, okay, those are nice melanocytes. In lab, certainly we can look at that. It's a really fun slide to look at, to see those melanocytes in there. All right, so that's the stratum basale. And then right on top of that, or superficial to the basale, is what layer? Stratum spinosum. And then on top of that is the, I see these dark cells, the stratum granulosum. And then on top of that, I see this white line. These cells now are very clear. They don't have granules in them. They don't pick up a lot of stain. And so they're clear. Another name for clear is lucid. If somebody is speaking very clearly so you can understand them, you say, well, that person is lucid. We really understand what he's talking about. All right, so this layer is called the stratum lucidum because it is clear. This is a layer that's not in thin skin. And then superficial to stratum lucidum is the stratum corneum. What's the chemical that all of these cells are loaded with that protect the skin? Keratin. It's intracellular. Don't forget, the strong chemical in the reticular layer, which provides strength to the skin, is what? Collagen. And where do you find that collagen? Intracellular or extracellular? Extracellular, because it's a connective tissue, not an epithelium. All right, so that's how you should think about all those things. All right, and I have the different layers in your notes. Okay, stratum lucidum, the clear layer, appears only in thick skin right here. Ah, good thing I looked at my slide. There's something that I didn't mention, and maybe I should. It's not used very commonly in modern times, but some people might use it. Another name for the stratum basale, which is this growing layer right here, is called the stratum germinativum. And germinativum comes from the word germinating or germination. What does germination kind of mean? Does anybody know what germination means? Like if you take a seed that's just sitting there, not doing anything, you put it in water and soil, then it starts to grow. We say it is germinating. And it's getting bigger by what kind of process? It's growing by mitosis, right? That's one of the processes of mitosis. So that's how come sometimes we call this the stratum germinativum. You don't ever have to tell me that on a practicum, but you might run into that sometime. Or germinating layer, because it's the living layer. All right, I talked about the dermis already. Okay, what kind of connective tissue it is. We talked about collagen, where you find it. Oh, what name the cell that produces collagen and elastic fibers and even reticular fibers. And you would find them here. My cursor, get over there. So here's one. And that indeed, somebody said fibroblasts, and you're exactly right. Okay, and these up over here are not fibroblasts because they don't secrete fibers. What do we call these here? Keratinocytes, because they synthesize keratin, which is intracellular. Okay, so that's layers. And we talked about some of these other things. Skin color. Skin color is due to a couple things. We mentioned one thing, melanocytes. Right, and melanocytes produce a pigment that we call melanin. It absorbs sunlight, and sunlight is damaging to the skin. And some melanin is brown, some is dark brown, some is black. It's just modified a little bit. And what layer of the skin do we find melanocytes? It's a good test. It is the stratum basale, right? It's that living layer. These melanocytes are living cells. Right, so, and then another thing that produces skin color is blood. Some skin is highly vascular. There are a lot of blood vessels in these dermal papillae. And so some skin might look a little pink or might look a little red if you don't have a lot of melanocytes in that area. So could you name a part of your body that looks more pinkish than other parts? Yeah, your tongue would be one reason. Now, of course, you could tell me anything because I can't see pink. But anyway, your tongue, I never thought of that. There's another region, which is what? How about your lips? Are they pink? I'm kind of hoping it is, because otherwise I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay? So you don't have many melanocytes in your lips, but it's highly vascular, and if you ever cut a lip, you know how quickly it bleeds, right? It hemorrhages profusely as a result of that. Okay, so those two things make up skin color. And don't forget, melanin is the compound, the pigment that a melanocyte makes. It's a natural sunscreen, and it gives skin a black to brown color. All right, melanocytes produce melanin in the stratum basale. Oh, we said that already. Moles and age spots are an increased number of melanocytes in some little location in your skin. All right, so that's what produces a little variation in skin color. Freckles are an increased melanin production. And so the same number of melanocytes, but these melanocytes are a little bit more active. They produce a little bit more melanin, so that causes a little color difference. And then there are some people that have an inherited a condition. They are missing an enzyme that can produce melanin in melanocytes. So these people have melanocytes, but they no longer produce melanin because they don't have one particular enzyme that can make it. And that condition, when somebody has that condition, we call it albinism. So a person that has albinism, it's not really proper to call them an albino. It's better to call them a person with albinism because that's the abnormal condition they have. It's not a disease process, but it is abnormal because if we look in this room, what do we see? Do we see anybody with albinism? No, it's kind of a rare condition. So it is abnormal, but it's not a disease process. All right, so somebody that has albinism can't produce melanin, right? It's inherited, which means it's congenital. You're born in that condition, so you can't produce any kind of pigment anywhere in your body. So what color is your hair?
White.
It's going to be white, okay? And your skin will be white, except your lips are? Yeah, really bright pink or red, whatever color it is, okay? Okay, and underneath your fingernails, that's probably going to be pink or red as well because you have a lot of blood vessels underneath fingernails, and somebody with albinism doesn't have any pigments in hair or nails or anything like that. All right, so that's sort of interesting, but what problem could that cause for somebody that has albinism? They have absolutely no protection from sunlight. Right, so they can burn. Somebody has really fair skin here in Los Angeles can burn their skin in 1 or 2 minutes, but somebody with albinism can burn their skin in probably maybe a half a minute or within seconds if they go into bright sunlight. Right, so that is a serious problem. They're much more susceptible to skin cancers and burning of their skin. So we don't see many people down in the southern part of the United States with albinism. But if you go to, for instance, Seattle, probably you will see some people that have that condition. Okay, so that person is going to look exactly like the combination of their parents, whatever features they have, right? It's just that they're going to be completely white as a result of that. And other animals have that condition as well. And so if you have a squirrel that has albinism, what does it look like? It looks like a squirrel, except it's all white, right? So it's not going to look like any other kind of animal, right? It's just going to look like a white squirrel with really pink eyes and pink ears, and I don't know if they have pink lips or not. Okay. Another condition is called cyanosis, and cyanosis is a blue color. So if somebody has blue-colored skin, that's a result of maybe their cardiovascular system not working right, or their pulmonary system, which is their lung system, isn't working right, because when blood is oxygenated, it's bright red. And when it's deoxygenated, the pigments in blood turn blue, or kind of a dusty blue of some kind. Okay? And then when that blood goes to the skin, it imparts that blue color to the skin, and so that's a nice sign that somebody's not using their lungs or has a cardiovascular problem. And it's used frequently. As a matter of fact, every single time on a person, at what time in their life? As soon as you're born. Okay, as soon as you're born, there's going to be a physician or a nurse or somebody that looks at your skin color immediately, and if it's blue, right, that goes into a ranking system to rank the viability of that infant to know if that infant is in jeopardy of losing its life. Anybody know what that ranking score is called? Yeah, the Apgar score, and cyanosis is one of the features, and reflexes and other kinds of colors, right? So if there is a newborn baby, right, which we call a neonate, if they have a blue-colored skin, then something is wrong with their lungs, or maybe something's wrong with their heart and some of the great vessels coming off the base of the heart. How are you going to find out what their heart looks like and blood vessels coming off the heart? What would you kind of order right away? Okay, x-ray of what body compartment? The mediastinum, right? So that's an important term to know. Mediastinum, that will tell you the architecture of blood vessels and the architecture of the heart to help explain the cyanosis, and then once it's diagnosed, then we can correct that condition. All right, so cyanosis is important. If you get really, really cold, I suppose, your cardiovascular system slows down, not very much blood goes to your skin, and then it can turn blue as well, okay, because there's not oxygenated blood going to your skin. Jaundice is another condition, right? It's another kind of color. This color is not blue, not brown, but it's going to be a bright, bright, bright yellow, okay? Not a normal kind of yellow color, but a really bright yellow color, and that's due to a pigment that's being produced when red blood cells break down. They produce a chemical called bilirubin, and bilirubin has a very bright color. Usually, the liver can convert it into a product that's not so toxic, and you can excrete it from your body. So again, when a baby is born and they're bright yellow, their fingernails are going to be yellow, the whites of their eyes are going to be yellow, right? Even if they have really dark skin, they're going to have these yellow eyes that are really easy to tell. And that goes into the Apgar score again. And jaundice can be produced by an over-degradation of somebody's red blood cells. If their red blood cells are being attacked and destroyed, then a lot of hemoglobin is being converted into bilirubin, and they're going to have this jaundice condition. Jaundice can also be produced by a disease of the liver, because the liver helps get rid of jaundice. So it could be due to liver disease or the breakdown of red blood cells, and somebody's got to figure out which one it is so that it can be treated. Usually it's due to breakdown of red blood cells in the infant's blood due to an immune response from the mother. And it has to do with blood type. And in particular, the rhesus blood type, or Rh factor, you know, it can be either minus or positive. And if the baby is positive and the mom is negative, there can be an interaction with the maternal and fetal circulatory system to where the mother's antibodies actually start to break down the blood of the fetus. And then they're born jaundiced. Not terribly dangerous, but it has to be treated right away, because bilirubin is really toxic to young nervous systems. Their brain and spinal cord won't develop normally as a result of that, so it has to be treated. Okay, a birthmark, that's down in the dermis. It's a local increase in blood vessels, so that little part of your body is going to look darker as a result of that. Okay, and we all have like birthmarks probably all over our body. And it probably can change over your lifetime, depending on how much sun you get and other kinds of things. All right, let's look at some accessory structures. Can anybody list accessory structures for me? Hair, nails, muscle, right, and receptors, nerve fibers, for instance. Okay. All right, so let's see what I can find for hair. Oh, here's another nice micrograph. Of thick skin. Oh, one thing I forgot to mention. I got to go back. Okay, see these dermal papillae right here? I don't see any hair follicles anywhere. And so here's a dermal papillae that's poking way up into the epidermis. And in thick skin, there can be a group of these dermal papillae, and look what it produces on the surface of the skin. It produces a bump. But think in two dimensions. I see this bump in one dimension, but think in and out of the image plane. That bump persists as you go in and out of the plane. So it's not really a bump. It is a ridge that runs along the surface of your skin, produced by these dermal papillae. And commonly, what do we call these ridges in your skin? Right on the surface of your skin. Fingerprints. Okay, so these dermal papillae actually produce these fingerprints that you have on the palms of your hands, fingertips, soles of your feet. And what reminded me to mention that is, here I see a nice eccrine tube going up to the surface of the skin that's going to secrete a water and salty solution onto the skin. And I saw this picture right here. And here is just a nice enlargement, 20 times, of the fingerprint. And here you can see some of the openings of an eccrine gland to the surface of your body, right? Some sweat pores right here. Openings of sweat gland ducts, in particular eccrine. So you might want to call this an orifice, which is an opening to something. Orifice of a duct onto the surface of the skin. Okay. Oh, nails we're going to talk about. What about hair? Okay, let's look at this illustration of a hair. The hair bulb is underneath the, it's deep down in the dermis. Okay, and the hair bulb is the growing end of a hair. And so that produces, you have living keratinocytes. And of course, they proliferate and then start to move up out of the skin. This part over here, part of the hair that's underneath the level of the skin, the surface of the skin, we call this the hair root. All right, so the bulb is the living part. The hair root is now migrating up to the surface. And the part of the hair that's above the surface of the skin is what we call the hair shaft. Okay, so those are some important parts of the hair. And here is a gland that's always associated with a hair follicle. That is a sebaceous gland. And then here is one of those muscles that can produce a goosebump. When it pulls this hair follicle up. Okay, that gives you a goosebump. So this whole thing right here, the bulb and the root, is what we call a follicle. Okay, so this all is a follicle. And I'm not going to have you know the names of all these components of a hair root or a follicle, but if you're interested in hair, certainly you can pull one out of your head and look at these different layers underneath a microscope. Right, as long as you don't dye your hair. If you dye your hair, then it's going to just look all the same color. Okay. All right, and so what name the cell that gives hair its particular color, except if it's gray or silver or white? Yeah, melanocytes. So there are melanocytes in this layer, so the deepest layer really is part of the stratum basale. And I think I want to talk about that even right now. Okay, so here I see epidermis. What layer of the epidermis is right here? It's a little bit small, but I bet you could tell me, even from far away. What layer is this? Stratum corneum, right. Okay, and then we got granulosum, spinosum, and then what layer is this right here? Stratum basale. All right, which one of these layers is alive and living, undergoing mitosis, proliferating? Indeed, it is the stratum basale right here. Okay, let me go way back to the beginning of these slides, and I want to show you this one right here. That is good. So here I see the stratum basale, and it's moving up and down, making these dermal papillae. And what else does it make? It makes the sebaceous gland. And then where does it go? It goes all the way down to the base of this hair follicle, right? And so here you have what kind of cells? Dead or living cells? Living cells. And then it goes over here. So here are some living cells of epithelium, but where do we find them? Very superficial in the skin or deep? Because of this follicle, they're deep in the skin. And that's really interesting for the following reason. Let's consider a person that has burned themselves. And let's make the burn not too terribly bad. And we call that a first degree burn. First degree burn, you might burn some of the hair shaft off of your skin. You might damage some of these keratinocytes that are in the stratum corneum. But what are you going to say? Who cares? Because why? They're dead cells anyway, right? Okay, and they're going to grow back because you haven't damaged the cells in the stratum basale. But you've irritated it, so these blood vessels in the dermal papillae dilate, more blood goes to that area so the skin can heal, and what does that make the skin look like? It's going to make the skin look red, right? Irritated, because it's recovering from that first degree burn, right? So it's not a terribly dangerous burn. Okay, another kind of burn is a second degree burn. Second degree burn is when you really damage the cells within the epithelium and you damage the blood vessels so that they start to leak a lot of fluid. A lot of plasma leaks out of these dermal blood vessels and then it forms a blister between the epidermis and dermis. We call that a second degree burn. That's not very dangerous either because, just like a first degree burn, you still have the epidermis that hasn't been damaged, right? It's still there, maybe a couple layers of skin here in the stratum corneum. But since the epidermis hasn't been damaged, you're still not susceptible to a great degree for infection or dehydration. Right, but for a second degree burn, how can you introduce infection to a second degree burn? By popping the blister. That's why everybody says don't pop the blister if you have a second degree burn, because then you put a hole in your integument and you allow bacteria to get in there. Okay. All right, so take a guess. What the next most dangerous burn is? Yeah, first degree we talked about, second degree. Third degree burn is when all of the shaft of these hairs are gone, the epidermis is completely burned off, and even part of the dermis, maybe down into this papillary layer right here. So now you have no protection whatsoever from infection or dehydration. And what can you tell me about that person? Are they lucky or unlucky? You might say unlucky. I want to change your opinion. I think that person is lucky, and you're probably looking at me like I'm crazy. But let's analyze this slide a little bit more. So I said right to this layer right here, right into the papillary layer. All right, but what layer is my cursor kind of floating on right now? It's hovering over the, what layer is this? Of the epithelium, of the epidermis. It's the stratum basale. What kind of cells are in the stratum basale? Living epidermal cells. And look what happens to that layer. Where does it go? All the way down to the base of this hair follicle. So even if somebody has a burn down to this layer, through the papillary layer, I consider them lucky, because what do they still have? Every once in a while in their skin, they have a pocket of living epidermal cells that can repopulate that part of the skin. Okay, now it's really unfortunate, of course, that they have such a serious burn, but their skin can grow back as a result of that. As long as you help protect them from what? Infection and dehydration. Okay, now let's consider a person that has a third degree burn, not to this level, but all the way down to the base of these hair follicles. Now, is that person lucky or unlucky? Now, that's really unlucky, because their skin can never grow back because there's no stratum basale. All right, so we say that this hair follicle right here with the stratum basale layer is a reservoir of keratinocytes, right? They're kind of protected more from the harmful effects of what's ever happening on the surface of their skin. So if a person's skin never can grow back because all these stratum basale cells have been killed, what on earth, what can we do for them? Then they need a graft. They need a skin graft where we take some skin, right, in particular this epidermis from one part of their body, and place it on the part of their body that will never grow back, and then that graft will start to grow and repopulate their skin. As long as we can do what for them? Protect them from dehydration and infection, and that's a really tough job to do that. But there are some really good burn centers that are doing a fantastic job with that. All right, so that underscores some of the important parts of this hair follicle, okay? But there's an interaction between a hair follicle and this stratum basale, so it's an important thing that you should know. And what does that illustrate for you? The importance of knowing what? Layers, right? That's really important for knowing layers of the skin, how it's treated, what the prognosis is, and you got to know where those layers go. Okay, another accessory structure, okay, is a nail. So here we have a nail, and here's a bone in your fingertip, and the bones that make your, actually let's talk about what the heck is a finger in anatomy. You could call it a finger, but it's really a digit. Okay, so here I got five digits on this hand, five digits on this hand, and I'm really proud of that because I grew up working in a machine shop, and not everybody had all their fingers, but I do, so that's really cool. All right, so here are your digits. You have a number of bones in these digits. In this finger right here, you have three bones, and they're called phalanges. One is called a phalanx. So when you look at this right here, this fingertip is what we call a phalanx, which is what? The farthest away bone in your finger. And when something is far away, what kind of anatomical terminology do we want to call that? Distal, right? So that's your distal phalanx, because it's farther away. What about this first one here? What do we call that phalanx? That's the proximal. So we've got proximal phalanx, distal phalanx, and what do we call the one in the middle? Yeah, and that's the middle phalanx. Okay. We don't want to say medial, because that means toward midline. We just want to say middle, because it's right smack in the middle. So here is that distal phalanx, bone in the fingertip. And I can see, I don't see many muscles right here, but I see some adipose connective tissue. And then I see some epidermis. No? that's still connective tissue because there are blood vessels. And then here I see some epidermis. So here's the epidermis because it doesn't have any blood vessels. And then there's a fold in the epidermis. We call that the proximal nail fold. And it folds underneath the skin once again. Okay, and it goes into this region here. And this region here is what we call the nail matrix. You might like to call this the root of the nail, but it's not really the root of the nail. This is the growing part of the nail, and we call it the nail matrix. So a nail doesn't grow from the root, it grows from the matrix. So again, somebody can damage the root of their nail and even pull this whole plate out, and as long as the nail matrix is not damaged, what's going to happen to that nail? It's going to grow back. But if the nail matrix is damaged, for whatever reason, crush injury, fire, whatever, then of course the nail won't ever grow back. So nail matrix, then the nail grows out. Here's the body of the nail, here's the free edge of the nail, and this little fold of skin right here is called the cuticle, right, or the epinicium. And right under here, okay, you have a little thickening and a special arrangement of blood vessels that produces a little white crescent. That's called the lunula, right here. All right, so I think this is an exam figure, so the important thing to know is how this nail is growing. It's growing from the matrix, right, and not the root. The root is just this dead part of the nail that is underneath the proximal nail fold and the cuticle. Okay, what else do I want to talk about? Muscles, we talked about. Most of the glands we talked about already. I maybe say some other, here are some other glands that I haven't talked about. The major ones are sebaceous. Okay, where do you find a sebaceous gland? It's always associated with a hair follicle. Okay, so it helps lubricate the skin, prevents dehydration, prevents against some bacteria, in particular pathologic bacteria. We have some sweat glands, eccrine and apocrine sweat glands. Okay, the eccrine secretes sweat, which is a watery solution. The apocrine secretes an organic solution in the axilla. Where is your axilla at? Your armpit, okay? And around genitalia, that's your inguinal compartment, and external ear. And some bacteria can grow on that solution, and those bacteria produce an odor, so those regions of our body are a little bit more odoriferous compared to other parts of our skin. Okay? Ceruminous glands. Ceruminous gland is a sweat gland. It secretes cerumen, but in particular, you have it only in one place, and that is in your external ear canal, which is right here and right here. And there's a membrane in there that vibrates back and forth. It's really, really thin. And if it turns into a potato chip, it won't vibrate back and forth. It's just going to fracture and crack. And when it does, then you can't hear anything. So that ceruminous gland makes sure that tympanic membrane, otherwise known as the eardrum, right, stays nice and fluid so that it can vibrate back and forth due to cerumen. And that's a modified apocrine gland. Mammary glands are modified sweat glands as well, but they don't produce sweat. They produce milk, or early on in pregnancy, does anybody know what the product is called? It's called colostrum, right? So colostrum is a product that's being produced by, it's a kind of an incompetent product. There's not a lot of nutrition, but it does have antibodies, so it does help the neonate fight infections. Okay, and humans, just like other animals, have a series of mammary glands up and down their body, okay, but we usually only see two in people. And I forgot what the other ones are called, but they're so small that you can't see them. Maybe if you look really, really close, you can find them. Okay. I'll remember what they're called in just a second. All right, so that's it for today. Sign-in sheet is right here. If you didn't sign in, please sign in. And remember, a week from today is your first exam, and it will cover what we're going to cover on Monday, which is the initial chapter in bones. Okay? So the test will cover 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6. Okay. See ya. Yeah, I don't know if you can get out that way. Well, some students just persist and persevere, and you can find your way out, but it's not really good.